Hello again from Holden Village. Today is June 1st, year 2000. And in the fireside room this morning, we have Deanne Lagerquist presenting Called by Our Inheritance, How Can I Decide? Now let's join Deanne for her session.
These books, it's the way that academics get any exercise at all, is that we carry books around. So you can roll the tape back there. My name is Deanne Lagerquist. I am here at Holden this week and next week as a member of the teaching staff, although I'm here more of the summer, and it's my family's summer routine that we're at Holden because my husband, Rick Dunning, is the curator of the Portal Museum. When we are not here, we live in Northfield, Minnesota, and the reason for that is that I am a faculty member at St. Olaf College. And these 2 weeks, I'm doing a series with the title Called by Our Inheritance. In part, that's to get it to fit kind of with the summer theme, but also it wasn't a very big stretch. I've been working both on a personal scholarly project and then on a college grant-funded project related to vocation. And I think that vocation is the extension of our baptismal identity. And if we think of baptism as being that moment in which we come into the promise that makes us heirs, right? Then it is, and in fact, that verse from Galatians does talk about baptism, being baptized into Christ. Then I think to talk about vocation in the context of this summer theme really fits. And to talk about being called by our inheritance also fits, because what else happens with an heir except that legacy propels you to do something with it, right? The legacy probably doesn't just sit. If it just sits, it sits in some kind of trust to do something with it. So that's the theme. This week, we've had 4 sessions. The first, just looking at the teaching about calling and vocation, Am I Called? The second, looking particularly at the intersections between vocation and job, the cluster of things around job and employment. Is it just a job? The third, yesterday, some of you were there, neighborly responsibility, to sort of think about the intersection of vocation or the way in which we are called into the other arenas of life that are not job related. And then today, how do I decide? Decision and discernment and decision. Let me just preview a little bit. Next week, I think I'm going to stay with the same theme. I'm probably going to do the same first and last, but I think we'll do one about biblical call stories, and I think we'll do one looking more extensively at Dorothy Sayers, using her title of one of her really interesting essays, Why Work. Okay, so with that introduction, today, decision and discernment. And as is usual, so that those of you who are here for the first, is anyone who's here the first time in this series? Yeah. I do want to say a little bit by way of review, what do I mean by the word vocation or calling? What's involved in this? When we use those words in a technical, theological way, as I've said several times, one of the things that I did last spring as part of this college project was a series of 4 focus groups with St. Olaf alums who are 5 to 10 years out of St. Olaf. We're trying to understand what, if anything, St. Olaf contributed to their sense of vocation and calling, or to use the language of our mission statement, that we equip students for lives of worth and service. Were we doing that? You know, and what did they think was worth and service? Often vocation gets folded together with this notion of service, and I think that's right. Well, one of the things we learned from those 20, 25 alums that we talked to is that many of them had some of the concepts. They were very interested in what they talked about as what I meant to do. And they were interested in making a difference, of being effective. When we asked them, when you volunteer, why do you volunteer? What sort of things do you consider when you make a decision about whether you will do some kind of volunteer work? Again and again they said, well, one thing was, who asked them? And the second thing was, would it make a difference if they did it? So that one person I know said, I don't do Habitat because, you know, lots of people do Habitat, and my doing it isn't any different from that person doing it, but there's this other thing that only I can do, and so that's the thing I'm going to do, right? But other people said, well, Habitat, I do that because of who asked me and because I can see right away what a difference it makes in someone's life. Okay, so they had different decisions, but both with that concern that there's some effectiveness to their work. Okay, now, most basically, what we mean by a technical use of these synonyms, vocation and calling, is, first of all, it says something about being, or, if you will, about our identity. Vocation and calling in the theological sense, particularly as set forward by the 16th century reformers, Luther and Calvin in particular, begins with who we are, or as church people are often wont to say, whose we are. So that the being is, and if you read my bio up there, I'm pedantically using this, the being is that each of us is God's own child, loved, forgiven, and given faith. That's where vocation begins. Who am I? Hearing, so that vocation, as I'm sure all of you know, the word vocation is the same word as voice, right? So vocation and calling, it's what we hear. The first session, we spent a little bit of time looking at popular uses of the word call. To be called on the phone, to call someone to dinner. What are you called? Namely, what is your name? Okay. This is who we are. The first thing we hear, the first message this voice gives us, from outside is to name us, to claim us, to say, this is your identity. You are God's own child. You are loved, forgiven, and given faith. Yesterday I talked about that using a different kind of image, that we are embraced by God's love. Right? None of that, you know, when you see someone you don't know very well or you've been seeing for very long and there's this kind of, shake hands, we're going to embrace, how are we going to do this greeting? With God, there's none of that, right? Just like Helmut Tilke has taught us to say, the waiting father, when the prodigal returns, there's no, well, let's see, how does he look? What shall we do? Do we want to hold hands? Do we want to embrace? What? No, it's all lavish acceptance. That's the beginning. This next part, then, is that being results in, organically, it draws out doing. So yesterday I said, once we have been embraced by God's love, this voice, think of the voice now as a square dance caller, right? You have been embraced by God, now turn to your neighbor. Right? So that faith becomes, this is a very standard construction among ethicists, faith is active in love. The dance goes on. When God embraces us, the temporal life on this planet does not end. Our bodily needs do not disappear. But those things go on, right? I was interested in the Bible study this morning when Franz came to this flesh-spirit distinction and the you are made heirs, now you're slaves to Christ. To think what we learned from the Greek about the Greek culture and the function of a slave was to take care of bodily needs. Very interesting thought came to me as I was listening to that. When we are given faith by God's embrace and turn toward our neighbor in love, it is in order that on God's behalf we attend to those mundane, ordinary, temporal needs of our neighbors, even as a slave would do. We're not enslaved to our neighbor. We are enslaved to God, who sends us to wash the feet of our neighbor. Okay. So all of this is by way of understanding what it means to be called. When we have this vocational view of the world, we respond to Jesus' call that we would follow Jesus forever by turning toward our neighbor now. We do not, now I want to go back to something I didn't finish last time. I gave you that set of initials, right? Instead of what would Jesus do, what would I do if you were Jesus? The point of that is that we don't become Jesus, but rather when we look at our neighbor, we see Jesus and we respond to the neighbor's need and gift as if they were Jesus' needs and gifts. Sometimes that means that we receive the gift as we receive the gift from God. Sometimes we lose that and we talk about vocation and it's all about us doing for someone else. Sometimes it's having the good grace to receive a gift from someone else and to say, you know, right now I really could use my feet being washed. I am exhausted. My body is tired, and I need what you have to give. I think we'll talk about various images later, but today we want to talk about how we decide then which neighbor to respond to. We want to move a little bit from the objective teaching to the subjective appropriation of that. We want to think about the way in which vocation is, of course, bigger than occupation and all those other things that fill up the circle of our life. Or of any particular limited manifestation. So maybe we could just make a little chart. If we grant this, if you grant me that the primary identity is child of God, then there are all these other parts, right? We're also a family member, at least a child, right? Everyone is at least a child, and some are also siblings, cousins, aunts, uncles, parents, spouses. There's at least that. We may be some kind of a worker, which has a function. So for me, that is, I'm a teacher, but I'm also a colleague. All right? And sometimes I'm even a supervisor, although I'm fortunate that in the instances when that's the case, it's more collegial than anything else. What else would you, what other kind of categories of responsibilities go up here? Other things that are part of your identity. When you meet someone at a party and they say, "What do you do?" What else do you say? This is the American thing. We usually respond with, "What do I get paid for?" But what else do you do? How else do you occupy yourself?
A friend.
Your friend? Uh-huh.
Spouse.
Mm-hmm.
Parent.
did this a little bit yesterday. What?
I didn't say anything.
We talk about being a citizen, and that's of our town, our state, of our nation, of the world, right?
Would volunteer things go under that?
Yeah, but you might be a volunteer in a school, you know, so let's put that here. There are communities that are not necessarily political or governmental communities.
I think some of my avocations is what I identify with. So I say I'm a singer and a reader. So I'm constantly sharing concerts or plays that I'm going to, or things that I've read, novels that I've read, and trying to pick up good things that other people have mm-hmm. read or seen or sung.
Right. Right.
Group member, like church, like club.
And in the United States, remember way back to de Tocqueville, Americans organized themselves into voluntary associations, right? So there's church, and we might want to say that because that's related to being a child of God, that's a particularly, you know, it's a little bit different than the other ones, like Rotary or Elks or the League of Women Voters.
Little League.
All of those kinds of things, which de Tocqueville tells us, and it's true, sociologists continue to tell us, are things where we come together because we're of like mind.
Yeah.
Okay? Because we have some common goal. You know, the Friends of the Library, the Friends of the Symphony, the Hockey Association, you know, we don't all want to belong to all of them. And that's why I want to put the church in a separate column, because the church, at least in Lutheran ecclesiology, now American Revival influenced understanding of the church is a little bit different, but at least the way Lutherans understand what the church is, we are the ones who are called out. That God has called us out to be the church. It's the same word, ecclesia, right? It's to be called. We come there not because we are of like mind, but because we are of the same identity, which is not something we have done. All right. But you can see here all the kinds of decisions we make constantly. This is a biggie, right? What career path will I follow? And it has twists and turns and junctions, but once you make that decision, it's kind of, it's a route. Who will I be friends with is a little bit like saying when you go into the restaurant, you know, and they say, what do you have for dinner? Well, I think I'll have the chicken. No, it's not just, I need a better example. I'll have the filet, yes? And how do you want that cooked? And what kind of potato? And salad. Do you want salad or soup? If you want salad, then what kind of dressing do you want? You know, pretty soon you think, I should have just stayed home and opened tomato soup. But the point is that we're always making these decisions. We're always making decisions along the way. And so if we have this, that what we do proceeds from who we are, we hope that this voice doesn't stop with, you are a child of God. I call you to take up your cross and follow me. That's the first big call to salvation. And then there's the big call to be a witness. And then we come to all these multiple callings. We hope that we get some help in that.
Dan, have you thought a lot about why it is that there are so many people in the United States and many of them in our churches that really struggle over, it's a kind of a related question, knowing God's will for their
yeah.
world. I mean, I think
yeah.
Lutherans don't really talk about that, but we're
yeah.
influenced by
and it's a kind of essentialism.
And I'm going to say some more about that. But let me just very quickly say, I think there are a couple things that comes out in two ways. One is God has one plan.
Yeah.
And if I don't find it, then I'm in big trouble.
Yeah.
Right? Well, I figure if that's the case, then God would program my Palm Pilot for me.
Yeah.
You know, I don't really have one. But if that was the case, I don't... The way God has been revealed in the witnesses I listen to is not like God is going to keep a big secret from me. It's this puzzle, and if I get it wrong, I'm in big trouble.
Yeah.
But that's very important for this matter of discernment and decision making. What are we trying to discern? The one true path? You know, as some buddy who was leading Bible studies when I was in college said, "Oh, the perfect man for you is praying for you even now." I'm like,
give me a break.
I don't think so. I would be. I hope someone is praying for me, and I hope some nice men are. But you know, I just don't see that there's this predetermined path. But the way we also hear that is, and I'm a little nervous about Parker Palmer on this point. Where is he? When he says, "Vocation does not come from willfulness, it comes from listening. I must listen to my life and try to understand what it's truly about, quite apart from what I would like it to be about, or my life will never represent anything real in the world, no matter how earnest my intentions." There's also this essentialism about myself, my true self. If I could just find my true self, then I would know what to do. And I say, well, we already know what our true self is. Our true self is that we are made in God's image, redeemed by Christ's action, and sent out into the world to do God's work of preserving life and serving the neighbor. That is our true self. So what we're trying to discern is how to get from that objective fact into the world. I want to say first three things about that. Much, 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 much about that is already determined, and we don't have a choice. You can sing. I cannot. Right? That's already decided. Okay? You are a man, and I am a woman. That is already determined. It's not going to change. As I look around the room, I think we are all native English speakers.
Yeah.
Now, you can see that as a gift or a burden. Right? But it's true. Much, much, much about our life is already determined. Our gender, the time in which we live, the nation in which we grow up, the talents that we have, much is determined. And then there's another element of our lives that we don't have much control over, which we might use the word contingency. Who do you run into? Right? What bulletin board do you read? How's the weather that day? All of us have those stories about the funny things that happen.
Perfect timing element.
Right, right. So the perfect guy has been praying for me for 20 years and I miss the plane and I don't sit by him. You know? But in my case, it's, you know, I took this job, he took this job. Now, is that because we were meant for each other forever? I don't know, but there's contingency. I unfortunately didn't bring this volume of poetry with me by the Czech woman who won the Nobel Prize a few years ago. She's a wonderful poem about this contingency. You know, by a hair's breadth, this didn't happen, and that didn't happen. Because you're the oldest and not the youngest, right? There's a lot of things that are beyond our control, but... This is the third point. Some things we do get to make decisions about. And again, the kinds of people who are sitting in this room, the fact that we have time and money that allow us to be at Holden, it's one of the things we get to make decisions about, it, our time and our money. And we are very fortunate in that. And we need help doing it in a way that's faithful, that is good stewardship of what we have. Here, I love Craig Dykstra. Some of you have heard me read these ones over and over, these kind of touchstone quotations I have up here.
course, Dykstra. In his book, Growing the Life of Faith. Now, he's not talking about vocation, he's just talking about the life of faith, but I think it's nonetheless useful. So our basic task is not mastery and control, or you could even put in, or success. It is instead trust and grateful receptivity. Our exemplars are not heroes, they are saints. Our epitome is not excellence, our honor is in faithfulness. So how do we make faithful decisions about how to use what we have received as a gift? It's not just grace we receive as a gift. You could say all those things we can't change are the gifts. So how do we use the fact that you're a man and I'm a woman and you can sing and I can't and that we speak English and that we have this much money and that much control about our time? How do we use those faithfully? That's what we're trying to make good decisions about. And we want to do it in a way that doesn't leave us troubled. Because if we're always second-guessing whether it's the right thing or a right thing, we're paralyzed. Now, Luther, in a kind of troubling treatise, Whether Soldiers Too Can Be Saved. It's a long treatise about whether or not you can be a soldier and who can bring arms against whom. I don't want to talk about any of that. I just want to read you the first part. And if you can, let soldier stand for, like, onward Christian soldiers, living in this life, in this time, before our own resurrection. Okay, so try to let soldier mean that here, not a fighting person. Okay. Here he's responding to the person who asked him to write this. I agree to your request and promise to provide this book in order, to the best of my ability, to give the best advice to those of weak, timid, or doubting consciences, so that those who do not care may be better instructed. For whoever fights with a good and well-instructed conscience can also fight well. Now translate that. For whoever lives, whoever serves with a good and well-instructed conscience can also live and serve well. This is especially true since a good conscience fills a man's heart with courage and boldness. Now, this is one of my little pet peeves about Lutherans. How do we get to be such timid people? Yeah. You know, I don't get it. I wish when you asked a person what is a Lutheran like, they would say, they are bold risk takers. They're always doing the craziest things. That's what we should be able to do. Yeah. Whoever fights with a good and well-instructed conscience can also fight well. This is especially true since a good conscience, based in faith, fills our hearts with courage and boldness. And if a heart is bold and courageous, the fist is more powerful. A man, and even his horse, is more energetic. Everything turns out better, and every happening indeed contributes to the victory which God then gives. Man, this is a theology of the cross guy saying this. What's going on? On the other hand, a timid and insecure conscience makes the heart fearful. It cannot possibly be otherwise. A bad conscience can only make men cowardly and fearful. This is what Moses said to his Jews. If you are disobedient, God will make your heart fearful. You shall go out one way against your enemies and flee seven ways before them, and you shall have no good fortune. Then both man and horse are lazy and clumsy. They lack vigor for the attack, and in the end they are defeated. There are indeed some rough and cynical people in service. They are called daredevils and roughnecks, for whom everything happens accidentally, whether they win or lose. The outcome of the battle is the same for those. The outcome of the battle is the same for them as for those who have good or bad consciences. They are simply part of the army. They are only the shells and not the true core of the army. Okay, so we need to have courage and boldness as we go forward, using the things that are determined in the places where we have some choice. So I would say discernment has two parts. One is in the midst
of what doesn't change. And this is what Luther was best at. Okay? If you're a milkmaid, what is the way you answer God's call as a milkmaid? It probably has to do with being kind to the cow. Don't kick the cow, right? Feed the cow well. Don't spit in the milk pail. Only ask a good price, you know? Sing to the cow, right? If you are a prince, well, don't do it for greed. And don't do it to lord it over one another. Every calling can be perverted. But the second thing we're after is, in the things about which we can make a decision, where does our calling lead us? So if we go back to the voice business and we think about the Christian life as a journey, as a pilgrimage, this is an ancient, venerable image for the Christian life. The first question is, how do we hear God as we move along? And the second is, when you come to a junction, how does it lead us? Both parts, both parts. Now, one of my colleagues, Doug Skirman, who is also very interested in vocation and from whom I learn a lot about how Calvin helps us to understand this, because Doug comes out of the Reformed tradition, he suggests that what are called the religious affections are very helpful, that we should pay attention, and I'm going to give his list and then I'm going to amend it a little bit. Actually, he starts from James Gustafson, one of his teachers, and lists these religious affections. Dependence. We need to pay attention to the fact that we are dependent on God. This is where I would put those things that are, we need to pay attention to what is given and to contingency. And he says, in dependence, we are aware of God's providence. This goes back to Carol's question, right? What is God's will for me? Is a desire to depend on God, but it constricts that a little bit. The second Doug points to using Gustafson is gratitude. The third, obligation. We have a sense of dependence on God and the interdependence that we have with the whole world. We are grateful to God for the gifts we have. We should also be grateful to God for the gifts others bring to us. We have a sense of obligation. Here I would want to use this phrase from the liturgy, our duty and delight. Okay? All of these things bring duties, right? An obligation. I'm a citizen of this state. No, and those of us from Minnesota, we often get a little arrogant about being from Minnesota. You know, oh, it's such a good place, schools are good, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's only going to be good if we fulfill our duty. If you're able to sing, you are obliged to sing for me. Not just so I can hear, but for me, right? Because I can't. I heard a chapel sermon when the St. Olaf Choir was singing in chapel one day this spring. And Bruce Benson, you always hear me quoting him, our campus pastor, he talked about that the choir sings for us, on our behalf.
In place of us.
Yeah, on our behalf. It was wonderful. And of course, when I went and talked to Anton, I said, Anton, that was so great. Do you think about it? He said, oh, I tell my kids that all the time, he says. They know it. Okay. The next is a sense of possibility. Here I would say hope. We bring to the task of discernment a sense that we are dependent and interdependent, a sense of gratitude for God's gifts, a sense of the obligations, the duties and delights that are attached to the stations in which we find ourselves, but also a sense of possibility, of hope, right? That there is a telos, a purpose, an end toward which we are going, and it is life. It is abundant life. It is the fulfillment of God's intention for the world. Right? You remember Carla Burkadal? Some of you have probably been up here with her. She's an Episcopal priest in Seattle, but she's been very involved in various kinds of ecological activism. And she said, when she first started doing that, she was astonished, although she ought not have been, she said, that what she had to bring was a sense of hope. Because there were all these activists who thought it was really important to clean up the environment, but who, in a way, didn't really believe they could do it. It's so hopeless. We have screwed up so much. We have made such a big mess. Just, you know, give it up. But Carla said, it's this sense of possibility and hope. We bring it to the task of discernment, and we bring it to our action in love, to our service to the neighbor. So when the call comes out, you have first be embraced by God and then turn towards your neighbor. It's with hope. You expect that you're going to be able to dance together, that something good will come, not turn towards your neighbor in only duty and morose responsibility, but turn towards your neighbor in duty and delight and hope. Hope for the neighbor and hope for yourself. Hope that what you do will make a difference. Okay, and then thirdly...
But sometimes isn't duty duty?
Yes. Yes.
I mean, you can't admit that either.
Yes. But that it's not always a great joy.
That's right.
Yeah, it's not always a great joy. And
that's... Big fans are not the easiest things to take care of.
That's right. That's exactly right. It's a duty. And here's where I think this vocation is bigger is really important. And that what we're doing is taking who we are into what we do. We are not defining who we are by actual consequences, right? So that in the times, I talked about this quite a bit yesterday, the way in which calling is not only a manifestation of growth and life, but it's also a way in which we follow the way of the cross. And the way of the cross kills. It kills always to give life. You gotta be clear about that. It always kills to give life. But the job to which we are called, this place in which we find ourselves standing, is not always fun. Right? Sometimes it's painful. We don't do it for the outcome. And that was the distinction I was making yesterday, that in the call comes from God. The origin of a vocation is God's love. And the outcome is that the neighbor is loved. But we must be very careful not to confuse the outcome with the vocation, or the vocation becomes a kind of idolatry. And that can happen in several ways. One is to embrace the suffering. And that's caricatured as, I hate bugs and I really need a hot shower every day, so I'm sure God must be calling me to be a missionary in Africa. Right? Because I will be so miserable there. I know that's what God has in store for me. That's one perversion of this. And that's not what you mean. The other perversion is to equate the particular calling with the whole call. And then we put everything into it. And another is to think that it's all about self-expression, right? And whatever makes you happy. Now, this isn't necessarily what makes you happy. Some days it is. And the happiness may be in meeting someone's need rather than one's own bliss. I'm very suspicious of that follow your bliss as a synonym for vocation. Now, some people, when they talk about that, have a much more robust and deep understanding. So I'm only suspicious about it. I'm not going to throw it out, right? But I'm a little suspicious that it means what makes me happy. Okay, so one more of the religious affections that come to us from the Reformed tradition, a sense of direction. Now, my colleague puts these two together, and he talks about a sense of meaning or purpose, or I used the Greek, the telos, the end toward which it goes. And the end toward which it goes is that that my service of the neighbor is an act of gratitude toward God, that God's love is expressed in the world. And so sometimes expressing love is hard work, right? It's rejected, or the people around you see your faithfulness as subversive, right? Or they don't appreciate it. This for me was a really important moment this spring when, again, in one of Bruce Benson's sermons, he talked about gratitude and forgiveness. And he talks about the economic image of sin and forgiveness. And he said, you know, one way to understand forgiveness is that God says to you, you don't owe anything. And how many of us have how many bills do you pay every month, right? Well, there's the mortgage, and there's the Visa bill, and there's the Culligan, and there's waste management, and there's the car loan, and there's insurance, and there's... And you get to the end and you thought, how can I make this much money and I have this little at the end? I just, oh. Bruce said, that's part of what forgiveness is. You don't owe. And then I began to think, why is it I always think people should be grateful to me? Why do I think they owe that to me? What do I do my work in order that they would be grateful to me? No, I don't think so. I do my work because, one, God has given me these great gifts, and two, he has given me these neighbors, and I don't know why I think somebody over there should be being grateful to me. Now, in a way, they should, because it's part of their vocation, but my ability to do my vocation is not dependent on their saying thank you to me. They don't owe me that, because it's not why I'm doing it. Well, it's a little bit of a tangent. Did that address your point a little bit? Yeah. Okay. This is one set of things, then, to think about in discernment. That these are the attitudes we bring to the task. I'm never going to get as far as a how-to book, but here we get a little closer. Okay. Partly because the how-to is what we each do. Not hidden in our prayer closet, but in very specific cases. So the way we would have to do that is to look at specific cases, and we'll do that a little bit next week when we talk about biblical call stories. Luther says, first of all, look to the need of the neighbor. You come to a crossroad, you say, man, I got all these gifts. I say this all the time with college students. The kind of students who get out at St. Olaf have so many gifts. So many possibilities. What shall I do? What am I meant to do? Well, look at what's needed. What the career counseling approach to this would be, you know, where are there going to be openings? It's not quite the same. What does my neighbor need? That's what calls to us. How do we hear God's call? From our neighbor. Others, and these are not contradictory. All of these are part of the mix. Another thing we want to look at are my gifts. You know, so I see that my neighbor needs help with something heavy. And so my gift to my neighbor's need is a strong husband. And I sent him over there to carry it. Not my arms are not my gift to address that need, right? Because Rick is stronger than me, and it's better for him to go and do that than me. If my neighbor's need is a ride to the hospital, doesn't much matter. Our gifts are equal in that regard. Okay? So another thing is to look at one's own gifts. Now, as I said before, sometimes, often, the gifts are the things that we have no choice about. Right? You have the intellectual ability for this kind of a job, or you have that kind of intellectual ability. Some people have the ability to think mechanically, and some don't. And you really don't want someone who doesn't designing your car. Right? We need safe cars. We need energy-efficient cars. And the way to meet that need is to get people designing the cars who have the gift to do it, not someone who is really good at composing music. Okay? Although gifts can be used in different ways. A third thing to consider are...
My father, Deanne, diagnosed his ailing Cadillac by playing the horn and running in and playing the note on the piano and running out and playing the horn on the piano.
And then he went to the mechanic and said, it's making this sound. Okay, present opportunities. This is kind of the contingency business. Okay? This can go for bad or for good. I'm going to be really frank about that. All of this stuff about vocation, as all of human life, has always the potential to go toward life or not. Present opportunities. You may have, well, here's the classic example that's still in our memory of our lifetime. Many women in the history of Lutheranism since the 16th century had gifts for pastoral ministry. The intellect, the theological understanding, the presence to lead worship, the pastoral heart, all of those things. And certainly there is never any lack of need, that doesn't make sense. There is always abundant need for those things. But, foolishly, those of us as a whole prevented there from being present opportunity. Now, here's a tricky thing about vocation. Because if you have a good understanding of the doctrine of vocation and you're in that situation and you don't get the opportunity, you say, well, how do I make meaning? How do I serve God and the needs of my neighbor in the midst of what I cannot change? And that's It's important that whatever you do, you serve God. But sometimes, where is the word of God? Where is God's call leading us, may want us to change something? So this present opportunities, it's a two-edged sword. It's a two-edged sword. But we do have to look at what are the possibilities. Right? What's needed? What are my gifts? And what are the real options? Sometimes you got to push for the option, and sometimes the trail is clear. You know, there's bushwhacking and there's on the trail. But present opportunities is part of it. Where's my list? This is very important. The consolation of the saints. We don't hear alone. Occasionally, you know, you hear God's voice all by yourself, but then you probably should check with someone and say, does this seem right to you? Does this seem right to you? The reason Joan of Arc was martyred was not because she heard voices. It's because other people didn't agree that they were voices from God. Now, I'm not making a judgment here that they weren't from God in Joan of Arc's case, but rather saying it's wise to consult. right? Because you may think, this is a really important need, and someone else says, but over here. Or you may think, there's no opportunity, and someone else says, oh, but there is, here, and this is how we'll do it. Right? So the consolation of the saints is really, really important, both about what are the opportunities and where to go. My favorite, current favorite example of this is Toy Story 2. How many of you have seen Toy Story 2? Only those of us with little children. Very briefly, what happens in Toy Story 2 is Woody, the vintage cowboy toy, goes down to help rescue a injured penguin wind-up toy from the garage sale. And while he is down there, he is kidnapped by evil Al of Al's Toy Barn, who wants to use Woody to complete a mint-condition set of these vintage cowboy show toys. And so there's Woody. And he's all fixed up, and his arm is sewn on, and he's got polished boots, and he's looking really good. And his friends, including Buzz Lightyear and all the rest, make this treacherous journey. They have to get across the street, and they have to go through Al's Toy Barn, where they meet tour guide Barbie, and, you know, this whole thing. And then they find him. And now Woody is faced with a decision. He can go with Jessie, the cowgirl doll, and the horse, and that
prospector
Sam, who's never been out of the box. Never been out of the box. He can go with them to Japan, to the toy museum, where his small c calling will be to bring momentary delight to thousands of toy collectors for many years. Or he can go back to
Andy's
house, thank you, and where he may get his arm ripped off again, and in 5 years or 2 years or a year and a half, Andy will grow out of him. And Buzz Lightyear stands up and says back to Woody what it means to be a toy. Just what Woody taught Buzz Lightyear in Toy Story 1. And they go back. And because of that, Jessie gets to have an owner again, because she goes too. Right? The consolation of the saints. We speak to one another what our core identity is and what we believe. And that helps us to know who we are. Okay, one more thing in this list. Oh, and the other thing is that this helps us to prevent self-deception. And here's another wonderful anecdote about that from Parker Palmer's book, Let Your Life Speak. Now, Parker Palmer often irritates me. I gotta admit that. But this story I adore. Parker Palmer was living at Pendle Hill, which is a Quaker community, and he was offered a job as president of a little school somewhere. And he said, because he was trying to learn to be a Quaker, he asked for a clearness committee, which is a wonderful Quaker tradition, which embodies the consolation of the saints. So he gathers together these wise friends, here in the technical sense, friends, to talk to him about this offer. And one of them looks at him and says, Parker, what do you think you'd like about this job? And Parker says, well, I wouldn't like this. And I wouldn't like this. And I really wouldn't like this part. The questioner looked at him again. Parker asked you what you would like. And again, a whole litany of things he wouldn't like. And there was silence. And finally he said, well, I would like having my picture in the paper. And then there's another long silence. And then one of the friends looks at him and says, Parker, I think there are easier ways to get your picture. We can deceive ourselves very easily. And we can begin to think, what would I do if I were Jesus? What would I do if I am Jesus? Instead of, what would I do if you were Jesus and you had a need? What would I do when the least of these has a need? So, and then...
You know, I think there's another danger in this consolation of the saints, though. And I think that probably most of the of the first women ordained since that, and that is that if you depend upon the consolation of the saints to tell you it's okay to do this, mm-hmm. then you'd never do it.
Right.
And I think that maybe that's the case now with the gay and lesbian community
right.
too. That if you wait for the approval of the main group, you'll never get off.
Yeah, there. Yeah. I want to say two things in response, Carol. One is, of course, the saints can be deceived as well.
Yeah.
Okay. The second is we ought never to equate the consolation of the saints with the visible church in its organizational corporate structure, as if they were only equivalent. Of course, we hope to find the consolation of the saints, but it's not a guarantee. You know, the Augsburg Confession tells us that the church is filled with hypocrites and sinners. So we will sometimes get bad advice from one another. And it has to be all of these together. And there may be a point at which one has to stand against. But even in those two cases that you suggest, you know, Beth Platts, someone was saying to her, you have the gifts. There are the needs. We'll help you get the opportunity. Right? Mm-hmm. And I don't know how many of you have seen that wonderful documentary Call to Witness about gay and lesbian ordination in the ELCA. I had heard this part of the story. Jeff Johnson says in there that United Lutheran, the pastor at United Lutheran, asked him out to lunch and said, Jeff, we want to call you as our associate pastor. And Jeff said, well, I'm sorry, but I can't do that. And the pastor there said, yes, I know, but we think you can. So I think, again, just as this man in the back, there are cautions. There are cautions. The fifth thing is prior commitments. All things are not possible. And often we have made prior commitments, and to be faithful to those closes off other possibilities. Okay, and that helps us to discern. Palmer talks about this, having learned this from an elderly Quaker woman, the way closes. It's not always that doors open, but sometimes things are closed off, and that's how we discern. No opportunities appear, or we make a decision that means that's not possible. We live in time and space. We can't be two places at once. For all the ways in which modern technology tries to teach us that we are limitless, we are limited, and we can't do everything. Sometimes, and Bonhoeffer is the one who inches us toward this. He says, sometimes you have to give up something, some commitment, in order to stay faithful to Jesus. That's got to be the reason why. It's in order to be faithful in this direction. Okay, now, there are certain things we can do that help us, of course, prayer, and worship, and hearing the message that we get in public worship, looking at the examples of exemplary Christians, right? These saints that Dykstra points to, I think that's very important. Participating in what Skirman calls in parachurch, I would say paying attention not only to the exemplary saints of other times, but also to the ordinary saints of our time. It's not just extraordinary Christians that help us to understand, but to pay attention to others. To be attentive to the needs of the least, always to keep that uppermost. And then there are these kairotic moments. Kairos, you know, this is the difference between chronos, ordinary time, and kairos, when God breaks in. Having said all of this, I do not want to diminish the possibility there are moments of clear insight. Right? Now, I'll tell you one of mine that is not dramatic. One spring, school was over. I'm sitting on the porch of the Archer house, having coffee, probably grading papers. And I had this moment of insight that in the last year, the thing that I had taken the most satisfaction from was being on committees. think. She's a sick woman. She is a sick woman. But what I learned was something about what my gifts are. And that Paul does include the gift of administration in one of his gifts of the Spirit. It was a moment of really clear insight that allows me to be of good conscience. Right? As Luther says, it makes my horse, even makes my horse vigorous. Because I know that. Okay. Now, how are we doing? Oh, we're way over. Oh, I'm so sorry. I want to say three quick things. One, bear in mind, in the midst of discernment and decision making, that whatever you do will take your life. Right? There's no choosing something that's not going to take your life. Secondly, do something. Don't be paralyzed by making the right choice or the wrong choice. Do something. That's the great freedom of understanding this theological view of vocation. Because this part, you are God's own child, loved, forgiven, given faith, embraced firmly, will not change. This arrow does not reverse. It all goes, that's part of the thing, last time I kept talking about the river of life flowing out of me. That river of life just keeps pouring in, and you got to do something with it. Do something. Don't be paralyzed. And third, remember, no motive is ever unmixed. No one ever has completely clean hands. And whatever we do, we must strive to act in conformity to Christ. In gratitude for God's gift of faith, we return praise to God and service to the neighbor. Okay? Those would be my sort of summary comments. Last time some of you heard me recite the end of this Mary Oliver poem, which I will end with. She says, in order to live in this world, you must be able to do three things. To love what is mortal. To hold it to your bones, knowing that your own life depends on it. And when the time comes to let it go, to let it go. So the first, to love what is mortal. To know that it's temporary. This world is for a time. Love it. Love it. Don't say it's going to go away. It's not worth the bother. Right? It's going to go away. It doesn't matter. To love what is mortal, knowing it will end. To hold it to your bones, knowing your own life depends on it. Not to love it at arm's length, but to hold it close because your life depends on it. You're vulnerable to it. And thirdly, not to make it into an idol. When the time comes to let it go, to let it go. So, thank you. I hope you will be able to talk about this at coffee break and on the trail. And we talked a little bit as we went along. And
what's the Mary Oliver poem?
It's on Blackwater Pond. And I used to be able to recite the whole thing. I'm not sure I could get it all out. But the first part is about, look, the trees are turning themselves into pillars of light. And then it's about the cattails and all the ponds. No matter what their name is, are nameless now. Every year, everything I have ever learned in my life comes back to this. The fires and the dark river of loss, whose other side is salvation, whose meaning we will never know.
What vine is it in?
It's in that green one, which someone has checked out, or I would have gone and gotten it and read it to. So thank you very much for your attention and sticking with me over time.